This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 19th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 117. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. Human rights activist Anastasia Lin on why the People's Republic of China is the biggest threat to free speech around the world. And Terry Glavin from Maclean's and the National Post on Iran and China, Canada's two biggest foreign policy challenges of 2020. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or did winter really hit Vancouver last week? Yes, winter, that season that was supposed to be cancelled by global warming. And Vancouver responded the way it usually does, with shock and gridlock. TransLink was so befuddled by the snowflakes and ice that it took to social media to ask people to avoid using TransLink and stay home. Universities, colleges, high schools, elementary schools, they were all closed. BC ferry sailings, cancelled. And the ice bombs? Well, they fell onto cars and trucks trying to get over the Alex Fraser Bridge and the Portman Bridge. As if ICBC, the dumpster fire that it is, needed any more business. At least David Eby, the NDP minister responsible for ICBC, is going to look at the possibility of making winter tires mandatory in Metro Vancouver. May I suggest that ICBC offer an insurance premium discount for any driver who invests in winter tires and keeps them on from October to March? So, this all happened in Vancouver, which hosted the Winter Olympics 10 years ago. The transport plan back in February 2010 worked only because of a freak early spring. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Taipei Times, Taiwan already independent, Tsai warns China. Tsai Ing-wen won a second term with a record 8.2 million votes, an outcome that was seen as a forceful rebuke of China's ongoing campaign to isolate the nation. In her first interview since her re-election, Tsai told the BBC that there was no need to formally announce independence because the nation already runs itself. "We are an independent country already, and we call ourselves the Republic of China, Taiwan," Tsai said. "We have a separate identity, and we're a country of our own. We deserve respect from China," she said. Paige Coburn reports in ABC News Australia, "Bushfire financial aid a slap in the face as family receives $1,280 after their Witaliba home burned down." A bushfire wiped out Al Bacon's town and left him with serious burns 2 months ago, but he says it may as well have happened yesterday. Mr. Bacon, who was uninsured, lost everything except some baby photos and clothes, and said he was disgusted by the small amount of relief funds the family had received. The federal government is also offering lost income allowances and has committed $2 billion to a new bushfire recovery agency, but that's separate to individual disaster relief payments. Elsewhere, the Red Cross is providing $5,000 emergency grants, and the Big Four banks all have relief packages available to their customers. Zhuang Pingwei reports in the South China Morning Post, "China reports second death from Wuhan coronavirus. A 69-year-old man died on Wednesday at Wuhan Medical Treatment Center, where all suspected cases of the viral pneumonia have been treated. The man had a muscle infection in his heart and tuberculosis when he was admitted to the hospital in December. It follows the death last week of a 61-year-old man who had tested positive for the coronavirus and also had abdominal tumors and chronic liver disease. Japanese health authorities said a Chinese man in his 30s south of Tokyo had tested positive for the new strain after visiting Wuhan and having close contact with a patient. The man was discharged on Wednesday. The same day, Singapore's health ministry reported its third suspected case, saying it had quarantined a 69-year-old man who had been diagnosed with pneumonia after visiting Wuhan. Two Chinese nationals from Wuhan had previously been placed in quarantine in the city but later tested negative for the coronavirus. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Samantha Swindler reports, U.S. bank employee says she was fired after Christmas Eve act of kindness. A Portland U.S. bank employee said she was fired after giving $20 of her own money to a customer who was broke and stranded at a gas station on Christmas Eve. On December 23rd, Emily James, a senior banker at a U.S. bank call center in Portland, said she spent more than an hour trying to help Eugenio, a bank customer whose paycheck from a new job had been placed on hold. The hold meant he couldn't access the funds, just over $1,000, and was essentially broke before Christmas. James said she got permission from her supervisor to drive out to a 76 gas station 14 miles from her office, but was fired on December 30th for unauthorized interaction with a customer. In the Seattle Times, Sydney Brownstone reports, when Seattle stores belongings taken from homeless cleanups, few get them back. Between January and the end of October last year, the city removed 745 encampments, most of them with little notice, compared to 468 removed during all of 2018. City logs show that from January 2019 to late November, field coordinators for the city's navigation team, the police officers and outreach workers tasked with cleaning encampments, stored homeless people's belongings in 343 instances, but only 30 deliveries were made to return the belongings. The same data show that city workers collected medication and medical devices at least 13 times in 2019, including antibiotics, EpiPens, and canes. Wallets, IDs, and paperwork were logged 32 times. On Czech News, Lower Johnson Street businesses in Victoria looking to hire private security for help with shoplifters. Salt House and other business owners on Lower Johnson Street are looking to hire private security to protect their businesses. Victoria Police Chief Del Menick says he understands, but officers just can't get to many calls. Menick said that between 25 and 45 calls for service that are often waiting for Victoria Police Department to respond to emergency. Victoria Mayor Lisa Helps says the council is moving toward funding downtown ambassadors, trained eyes on the street. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. We're welcoming Anastasia Lin, who is appearing at the Global Democracies and Retreat Conference in Vancouver. She's an actress and human rights campaigner, born in China but grew up in Canada, was the 2015 Miss World Canada winner, but was blocked from entering China for the Miss World pageant. Anastasia, you're coming to Vancouver to speak at this conference, which is happening the same week that Meng Wanzhou returns to court for her extradition hearings. It's also the week of Chinese New Year, as the Year of the Rat is on its way.
At this time period, it's especially important that Canadians are much more aware of what we're facing right now in terms of China's infiltration and the threat that it poses on freedom around the world. So I will be, first of all, speaking about my own experience of how I used to be a communist youth leader, and the path that I walked became to learn to utilize my own faculty and to think for myself. And that journey, I think, is especially important when we see so many Chinese students now on Canadian campuses or campuses around the world, like Australia, UK, US, yet still hold a very closed-off view up in terms of value, and oftentimes do not exercise their freedom of speech. Even defend the Chinese Communist Party's human rights abuses. And I think maybe my experience will give the audience a glimpse into what it was like to be willing to be open-minded and to feel vulnerable and step into the unknown and to, I guess, really just open up your mind. So that's the first topic. And secondly, given the situation in Hong Kong and Taiwan, which is so encouraging, it's super exciting. exciting for people like me, Chinese dissidents or obviously Chinese, who have felt the iron arms of China for so many years, and most of them never got a chance to speak out about the fear that they feel about the Chinese spies, informants, scrutiny overseas, and not being able to voice in their own community, not being able to exercise what the freedom that they should be able to enjoy in Canada. And also to understand what the issue about Hong Kong and Taiwan really is, why the youth in Hong Kong is fighting so hard to keep, to preserve what they have. So that's, I think, quite important for the Westerners, for Canadians to understand what they're really fighting for. Because I think there are some confusion, and some people call it a riot. No, of course, that's the official Chinese communist rhetoric. The other one is some people say that it's a student protest. Well, it's much bigger than that. So I think this weekend we'll have a good chance to address that. And thirdly, is the infiltration of Chinese Communist Party outside of China in terms of news, in the culture, in even newspaper and schools.
Communist Party of China was hoping to make last year all about the 70th anniversary of the revolution, but of course, people remembered it was also the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre. Hong Kongers took to the streets by millions. They voted with their feet to try to remind the world about the one country, two systems promise from the 1997 handover. And of course, here we are in 2020. Taiwan just voted to keep Xia Ying-wen, their independence-minded leader. So a lot of optimism is out there that people are exercising their voices. But in many ways, they're not being heard. We're also seeing what's going on in Xinjiang with millions of Uyghur Muslims basically jailed in a situation that's been described as cultural genocide. And the world isn't really responding. We've seen some American lawmakers take a stand. We haven't seen Canadian lawmakers take a stand.
You're right. We haven't. And that's why it's crucially important that we also make them hear our voices of support. Because, this is what I felt at the beginning. When someone who lived under a repressive regime all their life, or close to it, learned to exercise their voice, to speak up for themselves, it's a tremendous courage. And it's really, they need to be encouraged to keep doing that. But most of the time, what we hear from the West is silence due to China's economic power or the so-called diplomatic complexity. But it's really a self-justifying rhetoric. I think for people outside of China, in the West, to actually have the curiosity to learn about what is really going on there, it's actually of crucial importance for protecting our own democracy and freedom as well. This is the journey that the entire human race is going through.
We're just weeks away from the two-year countdown to the Beijing 2022 Winter Olympics. Do you think at this point in time that countries of the world should look at possibly boycotting the next Winter Olympics in Beijing?
It'd be quite wonderful to boycott, wouldn't it? I guess, back in 2008, when China was hosting the Olympic Games, there were calls for boycott, but at that time, the situation is quite different. I don't think globally there is awareness about what kind of brutality really is going on inside China. Now there are more and more reports, so we have no more excuse to not do that. And given my own experience, I was selected as the Canadian representative for Miss World, and that's an international contest. Now, they blocked me because of my views and my speaking up about freedom. They could do that to everyone else. They could do that to anybody who has tweeted about China's human rights abuse, like the guy in NBA. They could block anybody who has slight disagreement with the Communist Party and voice them openly. And then what we're both looking at is that, the rest of the world knows that Chinese communists have a tendency to censor people like that and block people like that. Therefore, they self-censor in order to go to China, to go to the Olympic Games. And that's not good for anyone.
Well, thank you very much again to Anastasia Lin for joining us on the Breaker.News podcast. She's part of the Global Democracies in Retreat Conference in Vancouver.
Part two of the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Joining me from Vancouver Island is Terry Glavin. You can read his expert commentary on the geopolitics of the Middle East and Asia in the National Post and Maclean's. First up, Iran. The killing of 176 innocent people aboard a Ukrainian Airlines 737. Most of the passengers were on their way to Canada. What next for Canada? Will there be justice? This is what Terry thinks.
In taking out Soleimani, it's quite possible, although I don't, you know, one shouldn't go too far in expecting too much in the way of coherence from the Trump White House. But this is a departure in the sense that for the first time, the Americans directly challenged Iran. They're not just defending themselves and their interest against Quds Force militias that have killed all those Americans in Iraq. They're not just, taking it on the chin in Lebanon with Hezbollah and so on. But they took out was basically the second in command in Iran, a guy who reports directly to the supreme leader, heads the Quds Force, to the pointy end of the stick of the IRGC, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. So it could be that the Americans have finally said, you know, enough is enough. The status quo is not something that we're going to tolerate, that we can tolerate anymore. I mean, we forget that in the lead-up to Soleimani's elimination, Iran and its proxies had been slaughtering people in the streets of Iraq. They'd been lobbing missiles into Iraqi military bases where Americans were being stationed. They were hijacking and blowing up shipping and tankers in the Straits of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman. There were any number of provocations, and Soleimani had met across the Tigris River from the Green Zone on, I guess it was October 15th, with senior Iraqi security officials and his militias, and had made it quite plain that, they were going to go after the Yanks in a big way. And they started going after Americans in a big way. They, fired some missiles into a base that killed an American citizen and injured a couple of contractors. And then the senior Quds Force proxy in Iraq led that siege of the U.S. Embassy, where they broke into the precinct, and they burned stuff and trashed stuff. They were threatening to do more. And the calculus was, and it's not just Trump. I mean, what does Trump know? You know, it comes from CENTCOM and it comes from the Pentagon, that here's an opportunity to take this guy out and send it around a message that we're not going to put up with this kind of crap. And that's basically, all that has happened. And it's really, I think, how Canada fits into this is we become this sort of this kind of diplomatic funeral parlor. It's just horrible, taking all of these deaths of these wonderful Canadians into account. But I don't expect that Canada is going to do anything more than they've done in respect of China, which is to keep our heads down and allow the corporate sector and the Iranian lobby within the Liberal Party, which is actually quite strong, the Khomeinist lobby. I mean, they've elected MPs, to sort of have their way. Everybody should just keep their heads down and the sooner we get back to business and the status quo, the better. And that, of course, is exactly the posture that the federal government has adopted with respect to China and the kidnapping of the two Mikes.
And that's what we saw this week. a corporate leader who has ties to the Liberals, family ties to the Finance Minister Bill Morneau, Michael McCain, the CEO of Maple Leaf Foods. He did an extraordinary tweet stream. He took over the Maple Leaf Foods corporate Twitter feed to put out his own version of events to blame Trump for everything, not even to blame the Iranian military for what it did and killing all those people, all those innocent people on the plane. This is a CEO of a company that is opening a meatless foods plant in Indiana, a very Republican state, and with the with government subsidies. He's made some mergers and acquisitions and taken government subsidies in the era of Trump. He's benefited from the Trump leadership in the economy. Meanwhile, his company also does business in China, where there's a huge market for protein. And Michael McCain himself has intervened and asked for the Canadian government not to enact any sanctions against China, for instance.
You know, I'm a Canadian. I love my country. But holy gosh, I mean, for this guy to suddenly become a folk hero. I mean, he's this kind of greasy corporate executive, as you say, with, you know, from a family with liberal credentials going back three or four or five generations, related by marriage to Bill Morneau. And he essentially, you know, tweets out all this rubbish that, I mean, it, talk about low-hanging fruit. I mean, who cannot talk trash about Donald Trump? I mean, you know, that could have been a teenager writing that Twitter thread of his. And yet, fundamentally, you know, the position that he articulated was objectively indistinguishable from what the Iranian foreign ministry is saying, from what the Office of the Supreme Leader in Iran is saying. I mean, that should kind of tell you something. You know, here's a guy who, as you say, has gone out of his way to oppose Magnitsky sanctions against the worst human rights abusers in China. You know, at the very time that the Iranian people, the Iranian revolutionaries and the Democrats and the liberals and the feminists are asking Canada to adopt a more robust position, to put level sanctions on the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps itself and not just the Quds Force. And, of course, 2 years ago, the majority of MPs in the House of Commons in Ottawa agreed that we should do just that, and yet it just sat there. And so this guy, you know, is suddenly some sort of Canadian folk hero. It's it doesn't speak well, you know. I mean, there's an old P.T. Barnum thing about how nobody ever went broke underestimating the stupidity of the American people. Well, no Canadian politician or corporate leader will ever suffer harm talking trash about Donald Trump and saying all kinds of stupid things. It's as long as you say wicked things about Donald Trump, you can get away with anything. Which brings us to Eddie Goldenberg and Jacques Chrétien and John Manley and John McCallum and Wenran Zhang and all those guys who are taking their public relations advice from the embassy, the Chinese embassy in Ottawa, on the matter of the Kovrigs and Kovrig and Spavor and Meng Wanzhou prisoner exchange.
Indeed, this is where it all comes together, because here you have Meng Wanzhou returning to court in Vancouver to begin the extradition process. It's going to be a long, arduous process, but she's beginning the extradition process finally. Here she is, the Huawei chief financial officer, daughter of the founder of the company, who is accused in the United States of deceiving banks so that Huawei could do business with Iran during the era of American sanctions. And this is where you get the intersection of Iran and China.
Well, interestingly, you know, just before all this stuff, you know, the Hellfire missile and Soleimani getting whacked, you know, sort of burst onto the scene as a big deal, Javad Zarif, who's the Iranian foreign minister, where do you think he spent New Year's Eve? In Beijing. Cementing a long-term military, cultural, economic partnership agreement. You know, this is the thing. It is surprising to me just how gullible Canadians can be sometimes. You know, we have been, people like Chrétien, who's, you know, this Denton's guy who's notorious in the G7 for having reintroduced China to the temple of global capitalism after Tiananmen Square, who has done nothing but make deals and kowtow and grease palms in China. I think he started, a week after he left the prime minister's office? And we also conveniently forget that he had to leave and resigned a cloud of scandal in Quebec over the sponsorship fiasco. And that's all he's been doing. And he works for Denton's, which is, I guess 2 years ago, it was formally taken over by Beijing Dacheng. So he essentially works for a Chinese corporate law firm, and arguably the largest corporate law firm on earth. And he gets trotted out as some sort of elder statesman whose wise counsel we should take into account as we deal with this diplomatic, you know, impasse with China. I mean, it's absolutely absurd. Same with John Manley, who was a deputy prime minister during one of these disco generation retreads from the Chrétien era. You know, he's on the board of TELUS, for one thing. Gets something like $250,000 a year for attending, I think, 10 board meetings. Has got about $2 million invested in TELUS shares. And, of course, TELUS stands to lose enormously if Meng Wanzhou's global telecom behemoth, Huawei, gets frozen out of our 5G rollout. And you've got John McCallum, who took $73,000 in free trips to China before he was appointed ambassador to China, had to resign in disgrace for admitting to publicly counsel, saying that Meng Wanzhou's got a good case here, and that Donald Trump, it's political, obviously, because of some stupid thing that Trump said. Although there was anything newsworthy in that. Eddie Goldenberg, Chrétien's fart catcher, is doing the same thing. He's been running errands between Wenran Zhang, pro-Beijing lobbyist who works for some, ensconced in some Alberta institute, I can't remember which, some oil company thing. They are really taking very cunning advantage of the gullibility of Canadians. And I hate to say it, but the ignorance of Canadians, that, this is Trump's doing, that Meng Wanzhou's, apprehension was a result of something that Trump did. And the U.S. Justice Department has insisted from the very beginning that the warrant that they issued was the consequence of an investigation going back several years. The Trumps had nothing to do with it. The first story that I wrote about the Americans warning us about Huawei, specifically about violating sanctions, our own sanctions in Iran, was 9 years ago. This isn't a Trump thing. This goes back a long way. And, of course, there's an easy way to resolve it. And that is that Meng Wanzhou tells her handlers to fire up the limousine and take her to the Peace Arch border crossing so that she can turn her into American authorities, where she will get the fair trial that her father says he has confidence she will get in the States.
And that's the best way to end this talk about current events here in January 2020. They're facing Canada from China, from Iran. And thank you to Terry Glavin of the National Post and Maclean's for putting these major issues, major foreign policy issues, into context for us here on the Breaker.News. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Giddy Lee, Alex Lifeson, and the memory of Neil Peart. Pert, the great drummer of Canada's greatest rock band, died last weekend after a lengthy battle with brain cancer. Pert was 67. When Rush fans heard that Pert was gone, many felt the shadow cross their heart. Rush was constantly innovating. There will never be another like Rush or Neil Peart. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 19th, 2020. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on January 19th in 1940, the Three Stooges film You Nasty Spy premiered? It was the first Hollywood film to satirize Adolf Hitler and the Nazis. Mo Howard starred as Mo Hailstone.
All right, go bust, next plan. We must extend our neighbors a helping hand. We will extend them two helping hands and help ourselves to our neighbors. Bevla! Item all! I fight 54 pages! Give me courage! Hauptabend! Hauptabend! Yeah! 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 Yeah!
Yeah!
Yeah, man!
Hallelujah!
We will now pause for station identification. This is NUTS.
When you hear the conch on the dome, it will be 3 o'clock, Bologna watch time.
3 o'clock, Bologna watch time.
Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.